This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is not the first time Ethiopian government has switched off communication when tension flared in the country.
That's VOA's Salem Solomon reporting on the media blackout in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Details coming up also. Ghanaians go to the polls to elect a new president on Monday. And a court has rejected the candidacy of ex-president François Bozizé for the coming election in the Central African Republic. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Ghanaians go to the polls December 7th. And the Coalition of Domestic Election Observers will be deploying poll monitors. Representatives of the group say it seeks to enhance citizen engagement in all phases of the electoral process through civic education. Months ago, the group deployed observers across the country to monitor political activities and actions by other stakeholders, including the police, in the run-up to the polls. In Monday's presidential election, incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo is expected to face a stiff challenge from former President John Dramani Mahama. To learn more about plans to monitor the elections, VOA's Peter Cloete reached Albert Kofi Arhan, the national coordinator for the Coalition of Domestic Election Observers.
Normally doing the long-term observation thing is to find out what the stakeholders are doing, the major stakeholders, in the electoral process. So we are on the field, we started the long-term observation around September, and then we put there to find out, like I already said, how the EC is preparing, how the parties are faring by way of campaigning, and how the skilled agents are also doing, whatever they are supposed to be doing.
So, have these long-term observers pretty much given you a preliminary report, an overview of what they've seen so far, and so that could influence the next strategy for the short-term observer in terms
of... They've been sending monthly reports.
Okay.
They send monthly reports about what they have seen. If there's any violence going on in the consensus, they report. If there's any activity by the EC, they will report. If there are activities by the CSOs or the NGOs, they will report. In fact, what they have been bringing us so far has been that there hasn't been much activity by way of the political parties. For example, they have reported that it's only the NPP and the NDC that are seen. The others are virtually negligible. You don't see whatever they are doing. They're also saying that compared to the last election where you had the CSOs and the NGOs busily engaged in promoting peace, sending peace messages. This time around, because of COVID, almost all of them didn't have any funding.
Mm. What is the relationship between CODEO and the Electoral Commission, the only body constitutionally mandated to organize elections in this country? What's the relationship in terms of what you find, what you tell them, and how they can improve upon their organization of these elections?
We have always told the EC that our role is complementary. We are in to promote peace, to make sure there's peaceful elections, there's fairness in elections. So the EC knows about it. And so we go to the field to make sure that the level, the fairness level, what you call the level playing field.
Right.
So ours is there to make sure that one, the EC is doing the right things according to law. They work according to
right.
regulations.
Right.
So CODEO is there to make sure that these things are well implemented. Especially, for example, on the day of the election, we watch out for all these things.
Before we leave, Mr. Ayin, what is your message? What is CODEO's message to, one, the people of Ghana, two, the security agencies that will be working on the day of the election, essential services, including the media people, and the Electoral Commission, about how they comport themselves during the election process?
I'll start with the police, the security. That they should make sure that they maintain peace. They don't look over their shoulder when they are supposed to be taking decisions. You see, they should do things with military dispatch and precision. If somebody has misbehaved at a police station, he should be apprehended and the right thing done. You see, if you look back at the some time ago, we had some by-election at
Ayawaso.
What happened there was, it was an ISO. We don't want anything like that to happen. People were in uniform and they were going around with masks. And it's like the police themselves didn't know where they were coming from. That was the impression that that was created. And I don't think Ghanaians would want to have a repeat of that thing, you know, again. And then again, we would want the political parties to behave well. There are rules governing elections. So if you go to a polling station and there's a problem, leave it to the rules of the game. It will be resolved by itself. Sometimes even the presiding officer can resolve the issue.
That was Albert Kofi Arhan, the national coordinator for the Coalition of Domestic Election Observers in Ghana, speaking with my colleague Peter Cloti. The UN Refugee Agency reports it is ready to resume its humanitarian operation in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region as soon as the Ethiopian government gives the green light to go ahead. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Aid agencies have been unable to provide vital humanitarian assistance to civilians and Eritrean refugees since fighting in Tigray began a month ago. The agencies are waiting to receive full and unhindered access to the region, in line with an agreement between the United Nations and Ethiopian authorities. The UN Refugee Agency reports its staff, together with partners in the Tigrayan town of Shire, already have distributed water, high-energy biscuits, clothes, and other essential relief to some 5,000 people who have become displaced by the fighting. However, UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says agency staff still is unable to reach about 96,000 Eritrean refugees in four camps.
We continue to receive disturbing reports regarding the Eritrean refugee camps in the region, which remain incommunicado. The details of damages and disruptions remain unknown until we are able to reach them and verify the information.
The refugee camps are located near the front lines of ongoing fighting. Hundreds of people reportedly have been killed since Ethiopia began its military assault on the region November 4th. Baluch says it is hard to verify the number of casualties because communications in Tigray have been cut off since the conflict began. He calls the situation very concerning.
Fears are that many Eritrean refugees may have already fled the camp in search of safety. UNHCR is discussing with the federal government's refugee agency on logistic arrangements and the need to assess the security situation before the resumption of humanitarian activities.
Meanwhile, the UNHCR reports some 47,000 Ethiopian refugees have arrived in neighboring Sudan. It says more than 1,000 arrived Thursday, and refugees say more people are on their way in search of safety. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As the Ethiopian government claims victory in what it says is a law enforcement campaign in the Tigray region, journalists say the government's internet and telecommunications shutdown during the conflict has made independent verification difficult. Additionally, local journalists face intimidation, detention, and harassment. VOA Salem Salomon has the story.
As conflict erupted in the Ethiopian region of Tigray last month, residents of the northern part of the country reported that internet, mobile phone, and landline communications were cut. Journalists say the government-imposed blackout has made it virtually impossible to get accurate information about the conflict. Mutoni Mumo is the Committee to Protect Journalists Sub-Saharan Africa representative.
We've had journalists, publication houses speaking out and saying that essentially it's incredibly difficult to document what's happening on the ground because it's, you know, you're unable to contact sources. It's difficult to verify what you're hearing. And it's in this kind of environment where the work of journalists becomes difficult, perhaps where you might even see misinformation going unchecked.
The federal government said the Tigray incursion is a limited military action against some members of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, after it attacked a military base. But the TPLF calls it a war against Tigray, one that its forces continue fighting. At crucial moments like the late November push by the Ethiopian military to retake the northern city of Meqale, news outlets were unable to verify facts about the conflict. Federal forces said they had retaken airport in Meqale and a key military post while avoiding civilian casualties. TPLF said there were widespread civilian casualties and that federal forces were shelling the city center. Major news outlets ran disclaimers saying they could not independently verify claims.
The jobs that journalists do are most crucial at moments like this. It's at moments like this that we must be jealously guarding the gains that we've had in freedom of the press. We need journalists to inform us of the ongoing humanitarian crisis to ensure that, if there are atrocities or, other injustices being carried out, those responsible ultimately are held account. We need journalists shining a light on what's going on.
This is not the first time Ethiopian government has switched off communication when tension flared in the country. In 2019, there were widespread communication blackouts following a coup attempt in the Amhara region. In June, the government shut down the internet in the Oromo region following the killing of a well-known singer, Hajalu Hundessa, whose death led to violent clashes. Despite the central government's tight control of the internet and communications infrastructure, it said the blackout in Tigray was conducted by the Tigray regional government. Ethiopian officials are also controlling the flow of information by arresting journalists. According to Reporters Without Borders, at least six journalists were arrested in the first week of the conflict. One of those arrested, Medhane Orba Mikael, contracted COVID-19 while behind bars. Momo said that justification for the arrests is vague and journalists have been denied access to legal representation. Reporters in the country say the crackdown has included in-person and online harassment of journalists and is having a chilling effect on the ability of the media to freely and accurately cover the conflict. Samuel Getacho is a journalist with the Reporter newspaper based in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa.
Whenever any of our colleagues are arrested, we don't care if that person is a Tigray or a Oromo, or we see them as an Ethiopian, we see them as colleagues. Any good society should leave the media alone because it's an important institution.
Samuel is concerned that Ethiopian journalists will leave the profession, making way for foreign actors.
When passionate people leave the media, it ends up being a PR, mostly Chinese companies implementing their ideas and pushing us to be like them. There's nothing wrong with being like China, but, many of us prefer to be like Ethiopia. We might take different ideas from here and there, but we are passionate. We were born here.
Reports suggest that the government has now granted the United Nations full access to the northern region of Tigray, and Ethiopia's sole provider, Ethio Telecom, said services partly resumed in cities including Humera, Dansha, Maikadra, and Maits Abri. Salim Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
A court has rejected the candidacy of ex-president François Bozizé for the coming elections in the Central African Republic. He planned to challenge the current president, Faustin Archange Touadéra, who is running for a second term at the helm of the deeply troubled nation. According to the French news agency AFP, the Constitutional Court barred Bozizé's candidacy on the grounds that he was being sought for allegedly committing murder and torture and was under UN sanctions. Bozizé seized power in 2003 before being overthrown in 2016. A former five-star general, the 74-year-old former leader has played a major part in Central African Republic's decade-long troubles, and some have feared he could try to stage a violent comeback. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has warned citizens to strictly adhere to COVID-19 regulations or face tough new lockdown measures. Ramaphosa addressed the nation after the country's daily COVID-19 infection numbers more than doubled. He said law enforcement officers have been instructed to up their game in monitoring adherence to COVID-19 measures as citizens enter the festive season. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
A visibly worried Ramaphosa did not mince words in urging South Africans to play to the rules or face tough restrictions.
Our main problem is that there are parts of our country where people are not complying with the current restrictions and the basic prevention measures are not being followed.
He spoke to the nation Thursday evening, the same day the country recorded 4,400 new infections from an average of 1,500 daily infections in the last week of November. Nelson Mandela Bay metro area in the Eastern Cape province is the country's leading COVID-19 hotspot. As a result, it was slapped with restrictions on alcohol sales and a 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. curfew, in addition to the existing regulations. However, for now, the rest of the country has been left under the relaxed level 1 lockdown regulations put in place a few months ago, to the relief of many people who had braced for tough new rules. Mercy Mvundla is a Johannesburg resident.
A bit of a relief. As for me, I was expecting very strict conditions. Although he did caution about a movement from province to province, he didn't state that traveling must be avoided or is banned.
Business owners also welcomed the decision to maintain the more relaxed regulations, saying it will enable them to capitalize on festive season sales. Chifiwa Chivengwa, CEO of the Tourism Business Council of South Africa, says the industry was not going to survive if stricter restrictions were imposed nationally.
It is a bit of a relief because it's not a blanket approach whereby we are restricting movement of people across the entire country. We have been saying this for quite some time, that when we impose restrictions, we've got to look at where the problem is and we've got to have a targeted approach to deal with the problem.
Wendy Alberts leads the Restaurant Association of South Africa.
As an industry, vehemently, we will continue to exercise the strictest of protocols. We will use our right of admission sign. We will encourage compliance at all levels. But I think there's a whole part in the entire country's behavior that needs to change, because it will be completely disastrous for us if we had to go into another lockdown.
Professor Salim Abdul Karim, chairperson of the Ministerial Advisory Council of COVID-19, warns that any complacence could see more areas in the country being slapped with stricter restrictions.
Let's look beyond the Eastern Cape and the Western Cape. There are two other provinces that are showing quite a worrying early trend, and that's KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng. The number of cases in KwaZulu-Natal week on week has increased by around 50%.
Over 800,000 people have been infected with the coronavirus in South Africa since March this year. More than 21,000 have died. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
A top official of the Borno state government in northeast Nigeria says farmers in the state will get help to increase food production despite attacks by Boko Haram militants. 43 farm workers were killed and an undisclosed number abducted by militants last week in the Zaba Ramari village, 40 kilometers from the capital, Maiduguri. Professor Issa Mart is the chief of staff to the Borno state governor. Mart spoke to reporter Mike Mboni about the help given by two farmers. He says the state government and security agencies are working hard to free the abducted farmers.
We assist all our farmers to increase food production in the state. We assist them with land. We assist them with seeds and also fertilizers. We are not sure how many of these farmers have been abducted, but for sure we know that about 43 were slaughtered by the terrorists in Zaba Ramari. And the military and other security agencies are working very tirelessly to make sure that if there are any abducted farmers or their families are released immediately.
Do you also have arrangement to protect farmers in the state following the attack at Zaba Ramari?
The state government, even before that, had been working with agro rangers, part of civil defense, to protect the farmers and also civilian JTFs and hunters. So based on what we have learned during this abduction and massacre, will definitely increase the number of personnel so that farmers are really protected when they are on their farms, because they are contributing to agriculture as well as food security. And keeping these IDPs in camps, it's not sustainable. That's why we are returning most of them back to their ancestral homes. And one of the easiest way really for them to be viable or to really help themselves or feed themselves is through farming. And not only will they produce food crops to eat, but also for sale. So that's why we really worked so hard to make sure that they are back. But we'll double our effort to make sure that security is also provided.
What message does government have for Borno people on the security situation in the state?
The message I want to really send to the people of Borno State in terms of the security situation is that the military is trying very hard, and will also appeal to the military again to really double their efforts so that we bring the senseless killing of innocent people to a halt. And at the same time, we will appeal to farmers and other indigents of the state to provide reports of any activities of Boko Haram to the security agents. And we appeal to them to really assist the military, the police, civil defense in bringing peace to our state, because it's a collective responsibility for everybody, the civilians, the other security agencies, you know, to work together and then bring peace to our beloved state and also Nigeria.
That was Professor Issa Mart, Chief of Staff to the Governor of Borno State. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Maiduguri, Nigeria. The World Meteorological Organization reports 2020 is shaping up to be one of the three warmest years on record, and a year in which extreme weather events have wreaked havoc on the lives and livelihoods of millions of people around the world. Here's Lisa Schlein again, reporting from Geneva.
The average global temperature in 2020 is set to be about 1.2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial level. Despite efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere, WMO Director of Climate Max Dilley says temperatures are expected to continue rising.
So what we can expect next year, we can't say if it's going to be the warmest year or not, but 2011 to 2020 was the warmest decade on record. We now have a prediction that there's probably about at least a 1 in 5 possibility of the temperature at least temporarily reaching 1.5 degrees between now and 2024.
That means climate change may be happening even faster than experts predicted. The 2016 Paris Climate Agreement sought to avoid dangerous climate change by limiting average global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius until 2050. WMO describes 2020 as another extraordinary year for the climate. It says extreme temperatures have occurred on land, sea, and especially in the Arctic. It notes temperatures in the Siberian Arctic reached more than 5 degrees Celsius above average. WMO Scientific Coordinator Omar Badour says that is particularly serious.
The Arctic part of the world is really suffering major change. We are breaking records after records. The change in the Arctic is not only for the region, but also for the whole global climate system. So anything changing in the Arctic affects also the weather extremes in terms of heat waves.
This year, WMO reports wildfires have consumed vast areas in Australia, Siberia, the west coast of the United States, and South America. It says particularly fierce hurricanes in the Atlantic have devastated several countries in Central America. It reports flooding in parts of Africa and Southeast Asia have led to huge population displacement, destroyed harvests, and left millions of people short of food. Lisa Schlein for VOA. VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.